time for Matt Geek Kevin. I will bring us our quick tip of the week. I recently got a new Subaru Outback and upgraded from one that was a 2018. And in my 2018, when I pushed the volume button in during a CarPlay session, it would pause or resume whatever was playing. It didn't take me long to realize that that button is now a mute button and things keep playing in the background no matter what. So I was losing my place in podcasts and it was driving me a little crazy. I found that on the steering wheel, if you hold the source button, the one that if you just press it would change between, you know, AM, FM, whatever other options you might have in the car, simply holding that down now acts as a play and pause button. So if you have a Subaru, and I believe that happened in the last 3 or 4 years, that's how you do it. And other cars may be the same. So experiment. Don't be afraid to hold a button down a little bit longer and see what happens. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Matt Geek Up 1085 for Monday, April 14th, National Dolphin Day, 2025. Matt Geek Gab, the show where we share quick tips like that. We share cool stuff found. We share questions, hopefully with answers or at least a path to get you on a successful troubleshooting journey. We assemble it all together into an agenda so that each of us gets to learn at least 5 new things every time we get together each week. Pete, your bell sounds sick today, but I think I know why. Sponsors for this episode include coda.io/MGG. That's where you can go to sign up for free and bring all your text and tables together. And a new one, storyworth.com/MacGeekGab, where you can save $10 on your first purchase. It's a cool service that uses quick, easy email prompts each week to get stories from your favorite relative, and then makes a hardcover book for you after a year. So it's a cool thing, and Mother's Day is coming up and all that good stuff. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. For now, here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And here also in New Hampshire, it's Pilot Pete. Good day, Americans. And everybody else around the world.
Yes, it's National Dolphin Day. That's
I got that.
Who knew? I and Pete's putting dolphins up on the screen if you're watching the YouTube feed. And if you're not, I don't think you're missing anything. That's right. Yeah. If you're not, we're sorry that you had to hear us talk about it. Yeah, it was interesting figuring that out with my car. I'm glad there was an option somewhere. And that was kind of the point of my quick tip was, you know, they often don't take functionality away when they upgrade things like that in cars. But I feel like they move things around a lot more than we're used to with any of our other tech. So,
well, and you could say with that opening quick tip that literally your mileage may vary.
Oh boy.
Dave.
Adam.
Was that not part of RTFM? Cause weren't you the person who told me that every time you buy a new car, you spend the time to read the entire manual end to end?
It's fair. I have not done that with this vehicle yet. So yes, it's been, I don't know if you were aware, Adam, but I got this car in February. I don't know if you remember my travel schedule during Q1 of this year.
No.
But unless I wanted to bring that manual with me on the airplane, and really what I should do is load the PDF. Here's another quick tip, right? I should get the PDF of the manual as opposed to the tune that's in the car. And then what I want to do is feed that PDF into a custom GPT with all of my manuals for all of my electronics and appliances and other cars. And then I can just query that GPT, and I'm not relying on it to go out on the internet and find whatever it might find. It's like, nope, use the data I already gave you. So that's That's what I need to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you could just ask it, why is this not working?
Right. How do I play and pause? How do I make it work? I'm curious if that's in the manual. Now that I don't know why I didn't, I don't know why I didn't think of it. To look it up before the show to see if it's actually in the manual, but I will look up now. Not right now, because we're doing a thing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well,
yep.
You can do it. Well, Adam does a quick tip, but even you're not probably that quick.
No, probably. What? I mean, the car's not that far away, but I'm not going to. But I will. Mark had, ironically, a ChatGPT tip. He says, I find ChatGPT very useful to make scripts to run inside of Photoshop. They can be added to Photoshop scripts folder and run via a menu command. These Photoshop scripts have saved me countless hours of work, and he's got one that will process images and change their color types, convert them to 8-bit or convert to RGB, or actually do all of that. He's got a script that he had ChatGPT write for him that converts an image to an Adobe RGB 8-bit file and image and saves it as a JPEG, and all that kind of automation stuff. You know, many people are sick of hearing me say it, but treating ChatGPT like your assistant and giving it data, the more you give it, the better off the results are. If you give it very little and just query it based on its data set, there's too much conflicting data out there on the internet for it to, you know, be able to be correct without checking, without confirmation. And that's why I love having it write scripts, because you run the script. Did it turn it into an Adobe RGB 8-bit JPEG? If the answer is yes, great. Now you know the script works. You know, if it didn't, now you know the script doesn't work. So.
Do you think Apple will ever give us our own on-device, like on Mac, GPT that we can just feed like all of our stuff into, and it just like the stuff that we want, but it never out on the cloud. It just all runs locally. Is there a world where that happens?
I would love. I mean, Apple has kind of said that's the world they want to give us. They've implied. I don't want to say that they've said it. They've implied that. And I think it would be a combination of happening solely on device or happening in Apple's the private cloud thing,
vault,
the online bespoke. I can't think of the name of it, but you know that. And I would love that. I'm also to the point where I'm half willing to upload my entire email archive to ChatGPT so it knows all that about me too. And I realize it would be better if I didn't do that. You know, I'd be probably violating a lot of other people's confidentiality, not just my own. So I have not done that yet. Yeah.
Well, we have a big problem. I mean, not a big problem, but like we're getting this mandate at work now to use GPT more, to use AI engines more and stuff to make our work more efficient. But there's a very, very clear mandate that you can't put anything sensitive or private or anything about the company. So it has to be real generic stuff. So like it's being used more, I would say, in marketing for like marketing research or, you know, like that sort of stuff. But even there, they have to be careful about like not putting numbers in there and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, it is a dilemma, especially in the corporate world, because, you know, you don't want your corporate secrets going up into ChatGPT, right?
Like, yeah.
So on the programming side, there's not a lot we can do with it. We can, you know, generic things that we might need, but anything that's client specific or proprietary, obviously we can't feed any of that.
Right.
That's seriously not allowed.
Right.
For very good reasons.
But I think, so, I think
you
that's, know,
if you had a one that wasn't in the cloud, sorry, if they having something that's not in the cloud, then, you know, avoids that problem.
Right. Yeah. And you can, like in theory, not even in theory, in practice, you could run your own local GPT for your coding stuff, right? That that ingested every bit of code that your company has ever developed, right? And now, probably would be a valuable thing for many companies to do. I don't know if you saw it last week, Shopify's CEO, I'm saying that right, not Spotify, Shopify. Yeah. Shopify's CEO came out and said that using, he called it reactive AI, generative AI, you know, some of these, like one of these things, using the, you know, these GPTs is now mandatory. You have to have fluency. You have to be using it as part of your job. It, you know, and I mean, it's kind of what I've been saying for a long time. Anybody that, especially small business owners, but even large business owners, if you are not using some ChatGPT or one of its ilk in your business, you are willingly and hopefully knowingly giving your competition that advantage. Now, there might be very good reasons not to. I'm not saying, therefore, to throw caution to the wind, you know, but it
just
should,
throw it all in there.
It should be eyes wide open, right? Is that that's kind of the intent of that. It's like, okay, make sure that you're doing this and you understand both the, you know, the pros and cons of choosing not to or choosing to use it. So I like what your company's doing, Adam, because you're kind of finding the path, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're working their way into it. And I'm sure they're going to do, I'm sure they will do an in-house probably server or something for the coders at some point, you know, but I mean, that's not, it takes some time to build something up like that.
Yes. Even,
yeah. And I mean, they even did announce our last like little corporate conference for our customers. They're building a in-house search thing. So that will be private and on our servers for our clients and stuff like that. So
smart. Huh. I like that. Yeah. Using it for your customer service is fantastic. Cause if you feed it all your knowledge bases and also like knowledge base articles and also every customer service query interaction that has happened over the last, you know, however long you have in your history, feed that into the GPT. Now it's going to be able to help you generate those answers faster.
They already did that for all of our documentation and I think our forums and stuff like that. So there's a bot on our site now that you can ask it a bunch of stuff. And I even used it the other day for a programmer question. Somebody asked me like, hey, can our software do XYZ? And I'm like, I think so, but I don't know specifically. So I just asked the front end bot on our website and it was like, yeah, here's the little code snippet you need. And I'm like, yep, there it is. Because yeah. we have a huge, it's called our source code kit, that we often have to go into and find functions that maybe aren't all publicly documented. I mean, it's all public stuff, that the stuff that's in that source code, because the source code is published, that part of it. It's like our template code, our front end language. And, but it's massive. So like going into the source code to try and find the function that you know exists is like, can be difficult. So that's all in that front end system. So for our develop, you know, third-party developers and stuff like that. So just asked it and was like, oh, that worked.
I have an idea, Adam, that we can workshop right here, because we've created, you know, a little bit of content here with this show over the years/decades, right?
And well, Dave, so you don't need help becoming a content creator, Dave?
Yeah, exactly.
Asking for a friend.
Yeah, asking for your LinkedIn friends.
Yeah.
So we have all this content, a lot of it, like starting, certainly not half of it, but starting maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we started doing, generating transcripts of the audio, but that's relatively trivial to do. It's a little bit time consuming ish, but certainly automatable. So we've got transcripts linked in the RSS and in the thing. They're not published on the site in an easy, digestible way, but your podcast client, if you use one that supports transcripts, it will pull the ones that we put in there. So we've got these transcripts. They're linked to timestamps in the show. Like, all that data is there. Why not? Could we? Is there a WordPress plugin, for example, that could, you know, ingest this stuff into a custom GPT that we could then put, like you say, a chatbot, or even just integrating it with search on the site, so that when somebody comes and searches for mesh Wi-Fi or whatever, like they could ask a fairly specific question. Like, have there been episodes where mesh Wi-Fi with, you know, long distance wired backhaul have been discussed? like that data's there. And
yeah,
like that would make our search on our site like super valuable for everyone.
Huh. Yeah, totally. I'm going to say I just took us down a long rabbit hole off of quick tips. So maybe we should jump back to that. But
sure. We have another quick tip about AI while we're here because Russ had something to add to the conversation, and Russ has added to this conversation a few times about Perplexity. Russ wrote, he says, Perplexity, one of the LLM engines out there, is great as a tutor. I'll give you one example, but I've asked it many questions about Italian and gotten really great answers because I'm learning Italian, Russ says. My course, Duolingo, has started throwing present perfect tense and imperfect tense, both past, at me in questions. How can I figure out which to use in any given sentence? Perplexity Pro responded, to decide between the present perfect and imperfect tense in Italian, consider the nature of the action and its connection to the present, and gave a slew of examples and like explanations of why to do it, and then also examples in Italian with their English translations. I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but and then it summarized some tips for ask yourself, you know, here's how you do this. Here's the cheat sheet, right? You know, ask yourself, is the action completed and connected to the present? If so, use present perfect. Is the action ongoing, habitual, or descriptive of a past state? If so, use imperfect, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it can be, it can be really helpful. It's fascinating. So fun stuff. That's where we're at.
Cool.
That's where we're at. Yep.
And David has a little. Sorry, go ahead, Pete.
I was just going to say a quick, just almost an ad hoc quick tip on that. Then is it, we've been talking about it, like everybody knows that we know or they know what we're doing. I don't know how to say that. The point is, rather than just asking questions, you've talked about giving it data, and you can give it all kinds of ChatGPT, all kinds of data. Yourself, you can upload PDFs, you can upload photos, you can upload all kinds of things, and you just drop it right into the interface, and it uploads it and it takes it. So if you haven't been doing that, try giving it some data. Like I gave my daughter 3 different resumes. I said, give me one, helping her put a resume together. Huh. And it took all 3 resumes, didn't repeat anything, and combined it into a beautiful PDF resume output. Boom, done. So
it's awesome.
Yeah. So give it input, I guess, is the quick tip.
Yeah.
Give it what you want. So sorry, took us down another rabbit hole.
David has a little follow-up to some of the backup stuff that we were talking about. Says, love the show each week. I followed Adam over, and I, even though I miss his show, I'm really enjoying this new team. Well,
same.
That's great. And thanks for following. Yeah. 2 weeks ago, you helped motivate me to update my backup strategy. I used to have a great backup strategy, as Adam taught all of us. But then I got a new MacBook M2 Pro, 1 terabyte, and got sloppy. I always backed up my family videos, grandson's soccer, and all my family videos backed up from VHS, DVD, other media, onto 2 SSDs, 4 terabyte. Those are full and needed more space, so I have 2 1 terabyte SSDs for saving the new soccer games and family videos, and then went out and bought 2 more 2 terabyte hard drives, the old spinning ones, 1 for Time Machine and 1 for Carbon Copy Cloner or for CCC backup. I just bought a new copy. Cool. Huh. So I think I'm pretty well set. Thanks for the motivation. Well, David, that sounds like a great upgrade to your backup strategy. So congrats.
Yeah, I agree. For years, listeners have been telling us here that we're expensive people to know because of all the things we recommend. But, right. but like,
you see how much we cost ourselves.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. But those kinds of purchases, I think that's smart for sure.
Yeah, yeah. That's the typical upfront investment that's going to be a moderate amount of money to save you lots of money for the alternative, is what I always tell people. It's like, you know, $100 2 terabyte backup hard drives, a lot cheaper than sending it to the recovery service that has, you know, a 50 to maybe 70% chance of recovering anything for you, and it's going to cost you thousands of dollars.
Yeah. 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 Future you will thank present you for having made this purchase for sure. Yeah. All right. I want to talk about StoryWorth. So Mother's Day is coming, and if you're still thinking about flowers or candles, let's level up this year, shall we? StoryWorth, our sponsor, is one of the most meaningful gifts you can give. It's pretty cool. Each week, StoryWorth emails your mom a question like, what's one of the bravest things you've ever done? Or what was your childhood home like? She writes her answers, and then at the end of the year, StoryWorth turns those answers into a beautiful keepsake book the whole family can treasure. I've opened a StoryWorth account and have been testing this. It's super easy, smooth, and very cool. The questions are thoughtful. The platform's intuitive. It's super easy to use. And I can't wait to like print the book and frame it. You know, it's going to be cool. This isn't just a gift. It's a legacy. Your mom gets to reflect and share, and you get stories you might never have heard otherwise. Like the time she went skydiving in the 70s or stole a modem from Radio Shack. Hey, it could happen. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/MacGeekGab. That's StoryWorth.com/MacGeekGab to save $10 on your first purchase. Such a cool thing. You don't even have to leave the house to buy it. And our thanks to StoryWorth for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Adam.
Guess what?
Hey, what?
Larry has a question for us.
Woohoo!
He says, hello, oh, wise geeks. I'm guessing you've heard this question already, but I will ask. Having fear of what the tariffs might do to Apple's prices, I'm looking at my 2021 M1 Max and considering whether it might be time to upgrade to avoid any price increases. Plus, it still has a $1,200 trade-in credit value with AppleCare till September. So I'm looking at the M4 Pro, and it has 24 gigs of unified memory. My MacBook Pro has 64 gigabytes. I know that a change in processor could be, with the change in processor, it could be more effective on the M4 Pro, but how much more? I'm looking at Activity Monitor, and about 10 or 12 applications are open, and they're using 42 gigabytes of memory. I closed everything except the Finder, and it was using up to 24 gigabytes. Should I just hold on to my computer and wait and see if something dynamic comes out towards the fall? And if not, just continue buying AppleCare until this dies? So I think the overall question here is, do I upgrade and maybe have less memory, or do I keep what I have and kind of just keep it going and continue with AppleCare and see where things land?
Or wait for the next best thing, right? It reminds me of an old, I think it was Gateway computer ad, where the guy's driving home with the Super 3000 in the backseat of his convertible, and the guy is just finishing the billboard on the side of the road for the Super 4000. It's like, you know, obsolescence is only a day away. So waiting for the next great thing is probably not the thing to do, because it's something new is going to come out tomorrow. Anyway, so that's number one. The other thing is, I would think buy the machine now before prices go up, and then if you can hold on to your trade-in for a little while and see if prices do go up. I don't know. If you guys got any thoughts on that, I think that the likelihood of prices going up that much, it may just be worth trading. You know, do it now, get your trade in, and go from there. And then he talked about memory. I've got 32 on my MacBook Pro, and whenever I go into Activity Monitor, I rarely see the memory being used above 16 to 20 gigs being used. So, although back to the advice, right? You buy as much as you can afford, perhaps a little more, especially if you're going to keep this machine 8 or 10 years, which you can easily do with Apple hardware. So that's some nebulous advice.
there. Right advice.
Yeah. but it's, you know, don't wait for the next best thing, because as soon as you do, the next best thing is going to be right behind it. Buy as much memory as you can. And as for the tariffs, I don't know. Maybe it's almost, I think it's almost like timing the stock market. You're going to lose when you do that. Just pull the trigger and be happy with your gear. Is that anyone else?
I have thoughts. Just to give you a comparison, your M1 Pro CPU, this is according to Mac Tracker, your M1 Pro CPU in your 2021 MacBook Pro has a multi-core speed of 12,000. Okay. The M4 Pro in the 2024 MacBook Pro has a speed of 22,000. So essentially twice as fast, not quite, but it's in terms of the CPU, twice as fast. So factor that in and bear in mind how, and you only you would know this, but bear in mind how often you're actually using all of your CPU power, because I'm recording a podcast right now, streaming video, doing lots of things, and I'm I don't know, 30% on my OG Mac Studio here, base model, right? So, just like think about that. Maybe 35, 40%, something like that. But it's not, I'm not taxing this CPU. I'm not anywhere close. And that's a, what is that CPU? That's a M1 Max. So probably very similar to what you've got there. I don't have it up in front of me. In terms of memory, I think the most important thing to look at is memory pressure in Activity Monitor and see. You know, he mentioned that it was using 42 gigs of memory and then it was down to 24. Well, you know, Unix in general and certainly macOS manages memory to take advantage of everything you've got as often as it possibly can. And so the amount that's being used isn't as important as how it's being used and how much is being used to make the machine respond faster, like with caching and things like that. So look at memory pressure. And the other thing, and you can see both of these on the memory tab and Activity Monitor at the bottom, you want to look at memory pressure and the amount of swap used. If you're using more than like a gig of swap, then that's telling you that you're using more RAM than you have. But otherwise, those would be the things I would look at.
Yeah, that's a very good point about, you know, it's going to use what you have if it can. Obviously, right?
Like, maybe not obviously. I mean, like, yeah, but yes.
I mean, that's the idea. If you have the physical RAM, it's going to want to use that over, you know, doing unified or going out to your hard drive. Now, what that means for performance versus one or the other, that's where I think it gets a little bit nebulous, right? It's like how, because Apple's SSDs are really fast and they've focused on this unified memory thing. And I guarantee it's not as good as physical RAM. I would almost guarantee, I guess I shouldn't guarantee that, but I would think logically that the physical RAM is going to be better in terms of performance overall. But yeah, I think you made some very, very valid points there. The only other thing I have to add is kind of goes back to what Pete was talking about earlier, is about not waiting for a machine. And it's almost the opposite, not opposite, but it's a complementary view that I've had for years. And I think I've said it before, but I'll say it again, because I think it's important for people to hear. Buy a machine when you need a machine. I'm only saying that here because I don't know. It doesn't sound like maybe he needs a new machine. He's just worried about the tariff pricing stuff and wants to get ahead of the curve. But the reality is, just like Pete was saying, with stock market, all this stuff goes up and down and up and down and up and down, and technology is changing so quickly. And you don't know what's going to happen a year from now or 2 years from now. So throwing money at a problem you don't have today because you're worried about something that might have, you know, is going to be happening tomorrow. I mean, buy a machine when you need a new machine and get the most machine that you can get. That's the basic advice I've given everybody. It's like, if you need a new machine, if there's really a reason why you need it, and the need can be, I just want one.
That's okay. Fun. Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes, for sure. Right. Yep.
Whatever your need is, I don't care what your need is, but like, don't just buy a machine because of some external influence that you're, you know, I don't know. I don't buy that way. I buy it when I'm like, that's why I don't have a new machine currently. That's why I'm still on this Intel machine. It's like, it does everything I need it to do. Why am I going to throw $2,000 at a problem I don't have?
Right.
Yeah. That's a great question to ask. I think it's probably not always a rhetorical question, right? Because we have all seen technological advancements that would actually give an answer to that question, right? It's because it's not necessarily, why am I going to throw $2,000 at a problem I don't have? That's a good question and is almost rhetorical. But changing it slightly to, why might I want to throw $2,000 at a problem I don't know that I have? Right. And so I'm thinking of when we migrated from dial up to cable modems or, you know, broadband connections, we all lived within the confines of what we had on dial up. Right. And it might not come as a surprise that I am an early adopter. I got, you know, a cable modem the day before I was ever able to get one. You know, I like wanted to be number zero on the list. Like, all, of course I did, but that's me. And then I would go to my clients. I was in Austin at the time. I'd go to my clients and be like, all right, well, we got to get you to a cable modem. And it was a hard sell for a lot of them. Even people that would, you know, always make sure they bought the latest and greatest computer. This was at a time when you basically had to buy a new computer every 3 years, if not every 2 years. Right. And I was like, well, why are they hesitant? Like, this is not, it's really not that much more money per month, like, or even per year. Like, well, what's the hesitation? And the hesitation was they couldn't see why they needed it because everything they were doing worked on dial-up because all they had was dial-up, right? They didn't, enough of their colleagues / friends / peers, whatever, weren't yet doing things that they were aware of that they now had envy, right? Like, wait, I want or need to be able to do whatever you're doing. And it's hard to show people, here's how fast the cable modem makes your internet browsing when they don't have a cable modem. Cause you know, I didn't really want to bring everybody to my house, but, you know, but like that kind of a thing, it, without knowing what your problem is, you don't know whether you should throw some money at it or even just throw some headache and time, even if it's not extra money. So I know that was a long-winded way of saying that, but welcome to the world of my brain. So
only you have to live in there, Dave.
I don't recommend anybody else jump on this thought train. No.
We'll run for fun in the Discord, but you know, people think computers are expensive now. Go back to the 80s or 90s. And what I'd add to that is, actually, I mean, if you consider just the straight dollar amount price of computers, they haven't gone up. They've actually gone, like, just not even accounting for inflation or just like the pure dollar number, right? They pretty much remain either flat or are actually cheaper.
Yes.
Which is just a weird thing to think about.
But even not comparing what they can do, right? Like, right. You're right, Adam. I used to know that every 3 years I was going to spend $3,000 on a computer. And now every 8 to 10 years I spend on a desktop computer. This was not even a laptop, right? And now every 8 to 10 years I spend probably $1,500 on a computer or $2,000 on a computer. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, I'm spending, you know, $1,000 a year on a phone and, like, you know, a watch. And like, so maybe if we add it all up.
But, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Will points out again, $3,000 in 1995 was a lot more money than it is than $3,000 is today. But correct, that's why it's $1,500 today. So it's probably pretty comparable in terms of percentage of inflation and like all these other things. Like they've remained relatively, and that's because of the advantages of manufacturing and technology and things have gone down and gotten faster. Like there's all these balances, right? Yeah. So,
yeah. Yeah, Moore's Law was interesting to follow right up until somebody decided that we could put two cores. Well, somebody, it was Intel, decided that we could put two cores inside of one CPU. And then Moore's Law was kind of out the window. It was like, oh, they don't just need to get faster and hotter and more power hungry, do they? Thank goodness. So, yeah. All right. Well, that was fun. Barry has a question. My early 2019 iMac died because its SSD died. Rather than mess around with it, I'm just going to boot the system on an external drive and put the iMac in the basement to be used for exercise and streaming TV only. Okay, repurposing. Fine, no problem. I have on order a Mac Studio, which hopefully will be here in the coming week. He's got some complaints about FedEx holding Apple deliveries. So I don't know anybody that can nudge that system. What I've been thinking of, and I've never really heard discussed, is that when you have multiple backups, like Barry says he does, which one is the best one to use for recovery, specifically with Migration Assistant on my new computer? He says, I have Time Machine, I have Carbon Copy Cloner, I have Backblaze, and I have QSync, which is data synced to my QNAP NAS. Do you have any knowledge or ideas on this? I need to get set up and going as soon as possible because I'd rather finish my taxes, which have been held in suspension, and I don't look good in stripes. Same, Barry. Adam?
Yes, this is pretty straightforward, especially since he said he needs to get back up and running quickly. So the correct answer would be whichever one of those backups is on your fastest local drive. So meaning it could be a Time Machine drive, it could be a Carbon Copy Cloner drive, but you probably, and if you have the one that's, what do we use these days? Thunderbolt, right? Yeah,
sure. Then USB
Thunderbolt. One, yep. Or USB 4 or 3 or whatever, but the one that is physically connected to your machine and the one that is the fastest. If you have a choice between the SSD and the spinning drive, use the SSD one. You know, like that's where I would start. If all you have is an over the network backup, then that's going to go a lot slower because it's going over your network. So you can also do the trick, although I never had much luck with this, right? There's the trick where you can stick a Thunderbolt cable between two Macs, right? I think that still works.
Yeah. Barry can't do that because his SSD died in his old Mac. So he's reliant on backup. But that is generally my first path to choose. It's not necessarily the fastest. It can be, but it is the most convenient and therefore often the fastest because if I'm migrating from a working computer to a new computer, it's possible. This is my brain working. Again, I told you don't want to go in there. That my backup probably doesn't have everything exactly up to date. So why not just transfer from the computer I'm using to the computer I'm going to be using? And and it's easy, right? You plug a Thunderbolt cable in or a USB cable in and effectively, you know, you're off to the races and it'll shuttle all the stuff over. And it usually works.
You want to know a dirty secret?
What's that?
I think the last couple times I've done it, because I haven't been in a hurry, I just let it do it over the network and it's been fine.
Yeah, and that too. I've done it over Wi-Fi. That's true. For sure. Yeah, why not?
But it's not fast. It's several. I mean,
yeah,
it's half a day, you know, basically. I just set it up and I walk away and I go do other things and then come back and it's done.
I have started a Migration Assist because I'm impatient. So I'll start it over the network, right, to get it up and running. And then I will dig out a Thunderbolt cable and plug the two devices into each other and watch it migrate from change. I know it's Migration Assistant, but it adapts and it says, oh, I've got a faster connection via Thunderbolt. It actually tests the two and says, all right, yep, we're going to go to Thunderbolt now. And then it uses Thunderbolt for the rest of it. So, It can do all kinds of things. The one thing, and it's been a little over a year and a half now, maybe, knock on wood, I don't have to do this anytime soon. That was an expensive summer a couple of years ago, losing all those computers. But the one thing that I've found in the past that really slows it down is if I have installed Homebrew. For whatever reason, that migrating, and it's probably because it's lots of little files or whatever, but it's super, that, like, and I think we all kind of realized this at one point. It was like, why is Migration Assistant taking so long? And somebody like looked at the logs or whatever, and it's like, oh, it's that, because it's tons of little files. So it doesn't really take advantage of the speed of the connection. You know, it's just one by one. But I mean, it gets it done. You know, you let it, like you said, let it go overnight. Good to go.
Yep. But fastest direct hard drive.
Yeah, I agree with that. You got anything to add to that one, Pete?
No, I really don't. That's it. You know, I would have, just on the surface of it, I would have said, you know, the clone, obviously. And
yeah.
But the connection is the key, right?
Yep.
Don't do it over Bluetooth. It's going to take a while.
Oh, man. I don't know. Yeah, you'd have to work pretty hard to make that happen.
No, I get that. Yeah, but that's my point. It's the connection, right? I mean, yeah. I would definitely, if you've got a clone, obviously.
Yeah.
That to me is, you know, that's going to be the most accurate. No.
Depends on how recently.
Least overhead. I mean, yeah, because of versioning and extra data in Time Machine. But
yeah, my gut, I have not done any testing on this. My gut would say that, would agree with you, that the clone would likely be a more efficient path than pulling from Time Machine. But that's assuming all backups are equal. Like the,
right.
You know, the place with your most recent data is the best one, you know.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's why I try to do a clone a couple times a week. Just, you know, I just plug it in and let it go and walk away.
But I mean, Time Machine's continuous. So like in his case, right, his SSD died on his internal. So who knows when his last clone was? It could have been the day before.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to Kiwi Graham's point in the live chat at MacGeekGab.com/Discord, Time Machine's APFS snapshots are pretty efficient. That is very correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, and really Time Machine's always been efficient, even when it was using, you know, the kind of sort of hard links in HFS Plus. It just mounted like a volume because it was a volume and you just read from it. So yeah. Yeah. Anyway, GW has a question for you, Pete. He says, I've used 1Password for many, many years. Would you guys suggest changing the passwords in 1Password at regular intervals, like every 6 months or every year? Or is it okay to just leave them be until they have to be changed by either a work policy or a site policy or perhaps a breach that requests or mandates it?
So, you know, it's always good practice to look both ways before stepping out into the street. If you're going to change your password, you're basically putting a blindfold on and stepping out into the street, because you don't know if you're stepping out in front of a hack that's going to get your new password, or if you're stepping out behind the bus that's already passed and it's never going to guess your password, assuming somebody's trying to hack your password actively as you're changing your password. I tend to be in the school that changing your password for the sake of change is a waste of time and non-productive, and perhaps even less secure. If he mentioned he's using 1Password, and that's great because you can use these powerful random passwords and not have to remember them. But if you're changing them to change them and you aren't using something like that, now you're going to go to something less secure because you're trying to be doing something that's memorable and therefore easier to crack. But I always like to refer people that ask the password question to Steve Gibson's grc.com/haystack. And he's got a great example in there. Try to visualize, close your eyes and visualize this. Unless you're driving, keep your eyes open. One of the passwords up there is D, uppercase D, 0, lowercase g, and 23 dots behind it. And then below that, he's got a password that's all uppercase, lowercase, numbers, and symbols. And the The thing about that is it's only a 23 character password. Ah. Whereas the D0G is 24 characters. So which one is harder from a massive cracking attempt? The easier one to remember is far more strong because it's going to take longer to get there and crack that 24 digit password as opposed to a 23 digit or character password. So, and it goes back to, I talked about it on the show a few weeks ago, I'm sure, is padding. I try to pad all my passwords with either a symbol or a letter or something along those lines. Now, some of them don't let you repeat characters and stuff, and that's kind of annoying. But I find that putting a long password in and padding it is helpful if I have to remember it. But I am firmly in the camp of it's a waste of time to change your password unless your company or whatever is forcing you so to do.
I understand why the length of a password is objectively better,
right,
more important rather than the entropy of the password, right? The variability.
That's the word I was for, entropy. Thank you. Yeah.
However, knowing that we have known that and knowing how humans are, if I were writing a password hacking algorithm, I would try lots of characters together in a row because like, mm-hmm, I would prioritize trying that over something else. Now, what you don't get with this is, you know, unlike somebody like we see in, you know, movies when you're cracking a safe, like, okay, well, I got the first number. Okay, I know I got the first one. You don't know if you're trying to hack somebody's password. You don't know if you've got 23 of their 24 characters, right? You're just trying random things all the time. So, yeah, I guess I guess the argument still stands. I can't poke holes in this. That length is more important than entropy. Yeah. Size.
Especially if someone doesn't know the length, because they've got to start by 8 and then 9, all 9 characters.
Correct.
And all 10. Yeah,
you don't know. That's why I use a not 4-digit passcode on my iPhone.
Yeah.
Because with a 4-digit, you can, you know, it'll show you, okay, here's the four things.
There's only 10,000 possibilities.
You know what you're trying to do. Whereas mine actually could be a 4-digit passcode, but it's not obvious because I choose that option of, you know, use a variable length. What I forget what it is, but that way it's just not obvious to someone who picks up my phone how many digits there are in my passcode. So,
yep. Same.
Yeah. You do the same thing, Adam. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know I've talked about this before too, but I actually use good luck finding it. If you can find my phone and still can't get it.
Yeah.
Like a character with an accent over it. And I know which character and which accent is in there and where it's placed in there. So good luck.
Yeah. Have fun with that. That's right. Yes.
I have something actually specific to add to this that backs up what you were saying, Pete, about, you know, changing it is actually probably worse than not if you're doing the right best password practices and you have something that is very long with, you know, a lot of randomization and stuff like that. And this came up because my company forces us to change our password every 90 days on our like Microsoft account or whatever it might be. And I have made a case, it hasn't gone through yet, but that this is a really bad practice. And I was doing some research on this, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, changed this requirement in their documentation back in 2017. That's how long they've recommended not doing this. He says, verifiers should not be required to change memorized secrets arbitrarily. And that's because their research found that when you do that, people tend to choose, exactly like you said, weaker passwords. And so they said, you know, you're better off teaching them to create the correct good passwords and then not ever have to change them. And especially, again, in this case where you're using something like 1Password and randomly, you know, generating a very long password or something with a lot of, what do they call that? Did they call it entropy? Is that what we just said?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's the right word, too. It sounds like we're smart using it. I'm pretty sure it's the right word.
50-cent word of the day, folks. Entropy. That's
it. Yeah, so this is in publication Digital Identity Guidelines 800-63B, Section 5.112, Memorized Secret Verifiers. So it's that section if you want to go reference it.
And it looks like the NCSC, which is the UK's National Cybersecurity Center, gave this same advice, I think, in 2015. Yeah, 2015. They basically said the same thing. Like it's pretty well accepted that forcing people to change their passwords is just not no bueno.
Yes. The only time they recommend it is when there has been a known breach or compromise. Then you absolutely need to go change it. So yes. Let's be very specific.
Right. That. Yes. Yes. Forcing change for the sake of change or scheduled change, not so great.
And even Microsoft changed this policy back in 2019. They used to require Windows passwords be changed like every 60 days or something like that, or that was their recommendation.
And
they got rid of that requirement too.
I suppose I could make an argument that in a corporate setting, I'm thinking of, and it's been a while since I've been in a corporate setting. So, but back when I was, and even if I wasn't the IT person, I became the de facto IT person for a lot of people. People would come to me first, or even when I was doing consulting, right? I knew everyone's passwords. I had to be able to get into their computers. This was not a time where multi-logins were a thing, but even when they are, a lot of times you're troubleshooting a problem with that user account versus another user account, right? You need to be able to get in. People don't want to have to be over your shoulder, you know, typing their password and then getting out of your way so you can troubleshoot and all that stuff. So it's likely, unless you enforce some really strict penalties for sharing your password with coworkers, it's likely that more than one person at the company knows your password, right? And so if obviously you would expire the account or close the account or certainly at least change the password. If it's my account, if I leave, you'd change my password. But if I leave, would you change everybody else's passwords? You know, who would be the one to realize, wait, Dave?
Yeah.
Dave knew everybody's passwords because we all gave them to him willingly, right? You know, and we don't expect Dave to do anything bad, but if Dave doesn't work here anymore, shouldn't we all change our passwords? So Dave's not here. Yeah, exactly. So I could see that being an argument for regular scheduled password changes in a company environment. Maybe.
Yeah, but the one that drives me nuts is we have two-factor authentication. So even if you know my password, you know, you've got to use Okta.
Yeah.
You know, you're not getting in without the second factor.
That's fair.
But they're making us change it anyway. It drives you nuts.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll be honest with you. Mine, I have to change it. They check back on the last 10 passwords. So guess how mine gets changed? Super long password one. Next 90 days, super long password, same super long password, two.
Yeah.
This is the problem, right?
I guarantee you, you're not alone.
And then I get to 10 and then I start at one again.
Yeah.
So it's not really changed. That password's not changed.
Right.
Well, so it's just an exercise in.
They finally changed it where I am. And the problem is, it was four previous passwords. So I'd go in and change it five times back to what it was.
Right.
And they finally put a kibosh on that. But
Let us know what you folks are doing and your thoughts on this, because even just as we're having, we spent 5 minutes talking about this and or more, actually, I think it was about 10. Yeah. And we're already kind of coming up with the nuances of this. So let us know. feedback@macgeekab.com. I'm curious.
You heard him. feedback@macgeekab.com.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you at feedback@macgeekab.com.
Indeed. I want to talk about our sponsor, Coda. So picture this. You're managing one of your many brilliant projects, because I know you've got at least three spinning right now. And instead of bouncing between 17 different browser tabs, a spreadsheet, a dusty document, and that sticky note you definitely didn't misplace, you've got everything in one tab. All in our sponsor, Coda. I started using Coda with one of my other businesses, and it's a game changer. Planning, road mapping, writing documents, setting OKRs, tracking projects, it's all there. And it's smooth, like rides a hoverboard while juggling pineapples smooth. Coda combines the flexibility of documents, the structure of spreadsheets, the power of apps, and the intelligence of AI all in one tab. And that means less time switching gears, more time doing the work that matters, and maybe even time left over to train a cat to run your morning stand-up. I mean, don't do that, but also maybe do that? I don't know. Seriously, more than 50,000 teams trust Coda to keep them aligned and focused. To try it for yourself, go to coda.io/MGG today and get started for free. That's coda.io/MGG to get started for free. coda.io/MGG. And our thanks to Coda for sponsoring this episode. All right, guys, I have a question for you. And it's a question from me that came from, well, not listening to, but doing last week's episode. What size battery do you travel with when you want to have something extra in your bag? And I'll leave it nebulous. The follow-up question would be, and what is the thing that you would be charging with that battery? Thing or things that you would be using that extra battery to rely on? Adam, do you know?
Yeah, I was trying to go find it. I don't even know the size of it. I want to say it's just a little like 10,000 milliamp hour thing. Okay. From Anker, however we say that. I'm never really sure.
Yeah.
I don't remember the little, it's like this little model and it's got a built-in USB-C cable. I don't think it was very expensive.
Yeah.
Here it is. The Anker Nano Power Bank. It's 30 watt. Yeah, 10,000 milliamp hours. Comes in a bunch of little different colors. It has a display on the front that shows you the charging. It has a built-in USB-C cable. So I'm usually just plugging that into my iPhone that also acts as like a little loop, and then it has a USB-C port for either charging, or you can also charge from, and then a USB-A on it. It's just a little tiny thing. It was 40 bucks. I think I got for less on Amazon.
It's 32 today or 30 if you're willing to not buy the black color. So
different. I got the little purplish color or whatever because it was like cheaper at the time. So like
that's the most expensive one now. That's 35 bucks now. Yeah, of course.
Or mine's blue. I think it's actually the light blue.
Oh, there you go. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. So based on that's what I use. I have a much bigger one that's, you know, massive that I've had for years, but this is my new go-to for especially for traveling.
How about you, Pete?
Dave. Size doesn't matter. But as long as you're asking, 20,000 milliamp is what I have.
Okay.
And it's, here's the cool thing about the one I have, and I can't tell you the brand. It's in my backpack, but it's got the Qi charging capability on it, or in this case, it's now MagSafe, right?
Yep.
That's even more important, which is nice because I actually had to loan mine one time on riding on an airplane. Scout's like, do you have a cable? And of course I had the Lightning cable. She was Samsung. But I had a Qi charging battery right there, and she was able to use it to charge her phone to make a text home. So that's it. It's 20,000 milliamps. It's got USB-C, USB-A. I don't think it has mini, but it has the Qi charging and a little display on it telling me the battery state.
Yep.
The basic answer is that, you know, obviously not going to try and charge my laptop off it, but an iPad and or an iPhone is that's my go-to battery backup on the road. And then back in cool stuff found right after CES, so late January, we had a couple of these, and there's some nice little ones that fit right onto your onto the back of your phone and in your pocket.
I want to ask you a question though. Before, and I'll share what I'm using now because mine has changed. You said, obviously I'm not going to charge my MacBook with it. And so my question is why?
Ooh. Well, because I don't have an Intel MacBook. I don't need it. Uh-huh. I can go all day.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. All right. Okay. Because I have always kept, like, I probably have, you know, 2 pounds of batteries in my travel bag. And last week we talked about that INIU, the 10,000 milliamp hour battery with, you know, 30 watt output and Qi 2. And I charged it up, you know, it came at like 60% or whatever. I charged it up and it was Saturday. And I was sitting on the kitchen counter kind of messing with things and messing with my laptop and realized, oh, you know, it's down to like 20%. I didn't charge it last night. Like, well, I have this battery here. It says it's got a 30 watt output on it. Let's see. And a built-in cable. Like, okay. And it's $35. So it's like, you know, the same price as the thing Adam talked about. A little bit more. Actually, Adam's is cheaper and arguably perhaps better because it's got the little screen on it. But this one's Qi 2, so, you know, MagSafe-ish, right? Yeah. So I could charge it that way or plug it into my phone. But I plugged it into my laptop, and it brought me from 20% to about 75%. So the 10,000 milliamp hours in that battery gave me a 50% charge on my M2 nice. MacBook Air. Right. And okay. And so I was like, okay, wait a minute. Now that I've done this, you know, I could give my laptop 30% and my iPhone a full charge on this thing with just this little 10,000 milliamp hour battery, lightweight, already has its own cable in there. And what I can't do is charge via Qi 2 and USB at the same time. Right. It's either or. It's not going to pump power out both ends. Right. So, like, I can't do both simultaneously, or at least maybe not. I didn't try it with another cable, but it was in that moment that I realized I don't need more than a 10,000 milliamp hour battery in my travel bag now, because to your point, Pete, it's rare that I would be in a scenario where my laptop needs a top up during the day, but not impossible. Right. Like the scenario would be, I forgot to charge it last night, right? Like that's, or 2 nights ago or whatever, you know, but like it could run out. So I want the ability to buy myself some time. That's the Boy Scout in me. Fine. Always be prepared. But like when, and then I thought, well, you know, I travel with 3 batteries in my travel bag. And my question to myself was, you know, I travel a lot in the first quarter of this year.
Too many.
I never used any of them ever. Like in 3 months of a lot of travel, and including like going to conferences where, you know, I'm using either my phone or my laptop at sessions, you know,
all day long.
Yeah. Right? Actually, I might have used, I have a Qi battery from Anker that, and it's like an Anker pop socket battery that's got a pop socket on it. I may have used that at South by Southwest. It's possible. I brought it with me. I brought it with me out of the hotel one day. I probably used it, but okay. So that's it. Like, when am I going to use these things? So yeah.
I would actually like to say one other thing about batteries and travel. And the airlines did a disservice to the public when you had to turn your Kindle off for takeoff and landing, and, you know, can't use your cell phone, has to be in the airplane mode, you know, and, you know, it's bad. It could bring the airplane down. And really the engineering hadn't been done. And that's a misstatement. It was the FAA that was doing that. They did a disservice to the traveling public, because I think that leads to the, you know, how many people texted, how many people did phone calls when they weren't supposed to be doing it, and it never hurt anything. And so they got away with it. And I'm
afraid just forgot and left their phone.
Or forgot. Yeah. Right. And my concern is that got people into the same mode with the rules about batteries. And let me tell you, I'm not worried about the battery in your AirTag. It doesn't have enough juice to do the damage. If it goes high order, it can damage the AirTag, and that's about it. But let me tell you, a laptop battery or one of these 10,000 lithium ion batteries, they go high order, it can bring an airliner down. And that's no BS. So when they're saying don't put those in the cargo hold, that's because there's no way to fight a fire down there. if it's in the passenger cabin with you and the overhead starts smoking, someone can get it out and put it. The flight attendants have bags to put this equipment in.
Smart.
Should it go high order. Yeah. They're on all the airplanes now. So they can fight a fire if they can get to the fire. Guess where they can't get to the fire? Down in the baggage compartment. So, they're not kidding when they say, don't put your batteries in checked luggage.
So ever. you're saying that the disservice, I want to make sure that A, I understand, and B, we articulate it right for our audience. You're saying that the disservice is that they made a rule that we all knew was not as important as they made it out to seem, and therefore we now apply that. We got in the habit of breaking those rules. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I just wanted to make sure that
this one, they're not kidding.
Right. Say that again, because I might have spoke over you.
This time, they're not kidding this time. The battery rules are important. They are life and death important.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. That's good to know, right? Because they did do us a disservice. Like when, you could shave during takeoff and landing, but I couldn't read on my Kindle, you know, and or my wife could knit during takeoff and landing.
I
was not all that comfortable. I'm very comfortable on airplanes. When my wife was knitting next to me during a landing, I'm like, this could, like, if we bounce too much, man, I don't know.
I got one word, Toronto.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So. Things can go badly quickly.
All right. Thank you for sharing that.
Now Pete's got me worried because they're not scanning for that kind of stuff, right? So I'm trying to think of like all the IoT things, all the things that now have LiPo batteries in them.
Yeah.
And the number of times people might not even know they have a thing that has a LiPo battery in it in their checked luggage.
I went to check a bag. I had like JetBlue Mosaic or something, so I could check two bags for free. And I was going somewhere, and I was like, you know what? Just check the second bag. I had a big suitcase for some reason and a small one, and I was like, check them both. Like, it doesn't matter. Sure. And the woman stopped, and she's like, wait, you were going to bring this on the plane, weren't you? And I was like, yeah, that was the plan. She's like, so you didn't think about batteries. Is there a battery in this? And I said, yes, there is. Thank you for asking. So I pulled it out, and she said, I asked her, I said, what would have happened? She's like, oh, they would have bounced the battery out. So in her mind, anyway, there was some scan that is happening to all of our luggage, and they're looking for that.
But here's where the hole is, I think, in the system, is if someone doesn't ask that and you're at the gate with your bag and now they're checking your bags.
Correct.
And those aren't getting scanned, I don't believe, before going into the cargo hold.
Yeah, because they've already been through TSA scans, but TSA doesn't care about batteries the same way the luggage does. Yep. That's fair. Right.
And Matthew in YouTube put up the comment that, he's joking, unless he can get out of a cage and put the fire out. And he goes, you'd think they'd have some extinguishers in there after all these years. And they do. That being said, they do.
Uh-oh. We lost Pete. I think they've silenced him, Adam. Oh, no. Pete's back. Okay, great.
I'm here. Oh, great. I went away? All right.
Yeah, you did.
I've been here the whole time. Just ask me. Matthew's point is they would have firefighting in the cargo hold, and they do. But standard firefighting does not put out a lithium ion battery, like you'd think it. Go on YouTube and look at some of those videos. You can, if you put it in ice, it actually makes a little igloo that insulates it, and it makes it hotter. So it needs to be submerged in water.
Interesting.
And the firefighting equipment in the cargo hold is not going to submerge your battery in water while it's catching everything on fire.
Yeah, right.
So it's not, there's no good way to fight a lithium ion battery fire in the cargo hold. So Sweet. While there is firefighting equipment down there, it ain't good enough.
Thank you.
Again, I'm just thinking about electric shavers, and I'm thinking about toothbrushes and
But I think to Pete's point that it's the larger batteries that are the issue.
Once you hit the 10,000 range, I think that it's
Thank you.
Maybe even 5,000, but yeah, your
toothbrush. But not the one in the toothbrush or the right. Like you said, the AirTag or those sorts of things. Yeah. So. Yeah. All right, cool. Thank you. Yeah. We have time for one more, Adam. Do we have time for one more?
Sure.
Okay.
Got a question from, who is this from? GW says, I'm not sure if this is a Geek Gab question. I think all questions are Geek Gab questions, but I had used the Mint budgeting app for many, many years until they moved to Credit Karma. And it's not like at all like it was. There are so many apps out there to choose from. Do you guys have any recommendations of a great one? It did everything I needed for budgeting and tracking. Thanks, as always. So it sounds like he's looking for a replacement for Mint budgeting, a budgeting app. Anybody got recommendations?
I do, actually. I answered this one. I really liked Banktivity. When I came over from Windows, I actually ran Parallels for years so I could keep using Quicken, because Quicken on the Mac sucked.
It's better now. We'll get to that. Yes.
This is 18 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So. And it sucked. Yeah.
And it, but Banktivity was fantastic, and you could put in, you could link it to your investment accounts and all those sorts of things. And I found it to be great. Now, over the years, I have since let go and let my financial advisor, and I don't balance my checkbook twice a month anymore like I used to. Yeah. But it's fantastic. If you need to track financial data very closely, I found Banktivity to be an excellent software.
Yeah, and it's still being updated all these years later. I looked at the change log or the release notes, same thing. And the most recent update was February of 25. So it's like they're on it.
Yeah.
Mac OS and iOS. So they are Apple only. Okay. Yes. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And the iOS app was pretty good, as I recall. And
it looked it was nice. I mean, I like the look of this.
Same.
Also, the pricing, I think you blew by the pricing. It looks like it's subscription, but it's not crazy. $5 a month for the base tier. I don't know what all the differences are, but.
Yeah, it's somewhere between $60 and $100 a year. So. And I bet it'll tell you that if you put that in your budget, it'll save your budget. So, you know,
right.
It literally has the opportunity to pay for itself. So, yeah. Huh?
I mean, that seems in line with probably what you had to pay for Quicken back in the day.
Well, this is just budgeting. Although I guess what else would you be using these things for? I still use Quicken. I was one of those people that lived through the dark times, and there were two versions of Quicken for a while. There was the old version, which I think was Quicken 5 is what I have in my head or something. And then they kept trying to release these versions that were this watered down thing that I'm sure was great, but not for those of us that were using all of the nitty gritty features of Quicken. And then Quicken stopped being an Intuit product. And that's when it really started to finally head down the right path. I still use Quicken.
Interesting. I did not know that.
But it's a much better piece of software now than it was in those dark times, you know. Quicken's what I use, but am I using Quicken Classic? I think I am. Yeah, Quicken Classic is what I'm using these days. That's kind of the more nitty gritty kind of thing. So,
is that the one that's still local, or all this stuff cloud now?
It's local, and you can choose to sync it with the cloud in various ways if you want. So yeah, and it will pull down your your data from your banks and sync and do all the things that, you know, things do, and it'll do your investments and all that stuff too.
So yeah. It looks like, I mean, it got to the point where I could import my statement and hit reconcile, and it would balance my checkbook with a couple clicks.
That's what I do with it. Yeah, it definitely does that. Yeah. So you were going to ask something, Adam?
I was just going to say Quicken looks like it's priced similarly to Banktivity.
Yes. Yeah, I think I'm paying about $100 a year, maybe less. I think maybe 60 or 70, but it's in that range of, yeah, it's worth, for me, it's worth paying for. It keeps me from not looking at my finances, which is good. I need to like keep an eye on things. So, all right. Well, I think we succeeded. We did the thing, and the thing is called MacGeekab 1085. So
I bet we come back next week and do it again.
Yeah, there's plenty that we didn't get to, so we're gonna have to. we're gonna have to come back to that. Yeah, I guess so.
Sorry.
No, a lot of rabbit holes this week. Yeah, there were, we did find a few, didn't we?
Yeah. Stepped in every one of them.
That's fine. I think so. You let us know though. Like this is our show. I don't mean that it's the show of the three of us.
All of our.
If you are
us
hearing this, it's our show. So let us know. Like we hit more than one rabbit hole today, as Pete articulated. Thoughts on that? Let us know. Really, we can probably rein it in. I know we can
tighten it up.
Yeah, we can tighten it up. We have tightened it up. This show's shorter than it used to be. And more focused, I think, than it used to be. So, and that's because of the conversation we all have together about what we want from this show. So, yeah, it's good. Thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks to Cashfly for providing all the bandwidth. Thanks to Clean My Mac for doing our monthly giveaway. Go sign up at MacGeekab.com/giveaway. Check out Adam's other show, the Debut Film Podcast. Check out Pete's other show. So there I was. My other shows, Gig Gab and Business Brain, everything is linked at MacGeekab.com, where you can also go. And if you just go to MacGeekab.com/review, you too can review this show. We would love it.
Five stars.
So Pete's camera's focusing on his five-star fist there. It's an open fist. It's not a shake. It's five stars. Five things, five stars. Is there one more thing do we have to share? Either one of you?
Yeah. I think it's on Pete's shirt. I can see it says, "Don't get caught."
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
See ya.
Later.